National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, May 12, 1995. This is tape number 10. Howard Braun and Selma Weiss are interviewing Dr. Leib Kessler. Would you give us your address, please?
Leib Kessler, 6516 Beacon Street. So today, I'm going to sort of tie together some loose ends, and some of this may be therefore repetitious because I don't have recollection of some of our earlier interviews. The interviewers, Howard Braun and Selma Weiss, brought up the subject of how much I knew about the early days of the United Jewish Fund, and particularly the subject of Sidney Stark, who was one of the dynamos of the Jewish community in the early days of Jewish community organization, which is the 40s of this century, that's 50 years ago.
Because you're talking about Senior.
Senior, that's correct, the 50 years ago. Now, I thought I'd make some comments about him because I did have some contact. At that time, and I'm talking about the 1940s, when I was then a medical student and began having first become active in Jewish committee work and Jewish activities, I, of course, had the opportunity to meet some of the leaders of the community at that time, and he was one. There was a certain division that existed in the community, and perhaps I ought to talk about it. I'm not wholly familiar with it, but I know some of the facts. There were three separate groups of people in the Jewish community, each group having its own perspective. There was, of course, let me go back and say, there was, of course, two major divisions in the community, and one was those Jews who were of German derivation and whose parents came to this country in the 19th century, as opposed to the Eastern or Russian Jews who either came themselves in the early part of the 20th century, or if they were sons whose parents came early in the 20th century, and when the German community had quite well established itself. The German Jewish community had established the principle of helping, developing charities and largesse for essentially benefits for the local indigent population, and particularly the population that began to come here with the big migrations of the early part of the 20th century. Theirs was strictly a charitable concept on a one-to-one basis, nursing care and food care and social services, and where they actually not only gave money, but gave of themselves time in caring for children. And one of the early developments along that line was the Irene Kaufman Center on Center Avenue, which is now known as the Hill District, but was then the center of the new Jewish immigration population. And that was directed toward these kind of urgent social services for a population that could not speak the language, didn't have any skills, didn't have available medical care. And so that this kind of charitable effort was somewhat different than the effort that developed in the middle part of the 20th century when we began to organize on the basis of a worldwide scope, meaning relief and care of people of Europe and other parts of the world through the United Jewish Appeal, the Joint Distribution Committee, and the United Palestine Appeal, which were the three major divisions of funds raised by the United Jewish Fund of that time. The second group of people were, of course, the new immigrants who became successful as a result of their efforts and determination. They were people who came, as my family, in the early part of the 20th century, and by the time 1940 and World War II rolled around, as the Depression receded, they became successful, dynamic businessmen. And of course, their interests, having a closer touch with Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, their interests were primarily directed toward the overseas efforts. But even among those people, there were divisions that were based on personalities. And in Pittsburgh in particular, there were three major groups that centered around the most wealthy people in town. They were Edgar Kaufman on the one hand, and he had his sycophants who served him, did his bidding, and so forth. He was surrounded, of course, by brother-in-law, John Wolfe, I.D. Wolfe. John Wolfe is his son, and Oliver Kaufman. And of course, as we can see on many of the buildings and charitable organizations in this town, the Kaufman name is very prominent. We have a camp named after them. We have a building at Montefiore Hospital named after them. We have the Irene Kaufman Center, which was, of course, named after Kaufman. So they were major sources of capital largesse at that time. There was a second group, and that was the Falk Group. And Leon Falk, actually his father, had an attitude that we did not or should not segregate ourselves into a community of Jews versus Gentiles, but that we should be more assimilative, in other words, be more a part of the community at large. And the Falks directed a major portion of their largesse toward the University of Pittsburgh, for example. In other words, now since 1940s, we've had a place called Falk Clinic, which is a major part of the university teaching program. Falk's son was Leon Falk Jr., and he was on the board of directors of the university, and many other affiliations not directly related to the Jewish community, which involved the Jewish hospital, namely Montefiore Hospital.
Which is a little chapel of Chatham.
Yes, right. Then there was a third group, and that was the group that came under Charlie Rosenblum. Charlie Rosenblum was the son of a very wealthy liquor manufacturer, Saul Rosenblum, and he amassed a fortune in the early part of the 20th century. And Charlie Rosenblum did nothing except his charitable work and his management of the family fortune. Charlie Rosenblum happened to turn out to be a very good friend of mine, and I knew him and knew him well. He's now deceased for 20 years or so.
What was the son's name?
Charles Rosenblum was the son.
Oh, and I see.
Saul was the father.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about them because my wife and I became very friendly with the Rosenblums, and after I began practice, Charles Rosenblum was married to Lucille Rosenblum, who was a harpist for the Pittsburgh Symphony. They had a beautiful home on Beechwood Boulevard. She, being very much of a musician, had been a world performer prior to her coming to Pittsburgh. It was natural that they led a rather close attachment to the musical life in Pittsburgh. But Charles Rosenblum maintained a position and had this turn taken the position as president of the Jewish Federation. But again, he had his group of sycophants around him. And they were all these sycophants would carry out the bidding. If Charles Odom would say, we're going to raise money for so-and-so, there was a certain group of men that immediately went to bat for that group. One of those groups was a group under the title, let me see if I can remember this, of the, I may think of it, I can't right now, but a group of men who were pretty much middle class, fairly successful, of which Sidney Stark, getting back to our original story, was one. Oh, they were called the Health Club, as a matter of fact. And they called themselves the Health Club because, in fact, they were primarily centered around the Jewish, we call it the YM and WHA in those days. It later became the Jewish Community Center as it combined with the Irene Kaufman Center. But at that time, Leon Falk was primarily the motivating force in developing this Y for Jews, the YM and WHA. Mm-hmm. And as the people who helped him raise funds and helped him run this, there was a group of men, not nearly quite as wealthy as Falk, but did his bidding. And they included Sidney Stark, Manny Spector, Buck Gefsky, let me see if I can remember others.
Let me get this straight. I thought you thought that you said that Sidney Stark was associated with the Rosenblum.
No. He was associated with Falk. But at any rate, because Sidney Stark assumed that I identified with Charlie Rosenblum, which I did, he sort of looked at me as the enemy. There was a lot of animosity between the various groups, and he didn't have much to say to me one way or the other. At any rate, I nevertheless always admired his dogged determination to help the Jewish people. He was tyrannical. He was had tremendous energy. He was an atheist. He was a socialist, even perhaps more toward the left than that. He was very outspoken, but it was hard to get much done without men like that in those days when the community was being organized. Manny Spector was another individual who was in that category. Sidney Stark had developed a rather successful dry cleaning establishment, a plant, did uniforms and that sort of thing, supplied uniforms for businesses and the mills and so on, and was quite successful. Manny Spector had a wholesale outlet on Lower Fifth Avenue, and these were men that really supplied the engine to the organization of the Jewish community in the early and late 1940s and early 50s. Sidney Stark, as I started to say, was one who was perhaps more outspoken, more dynamic, more aggressive, and somewhat hostile than the others, but never had a kind word for me. At any rate, his main interest, other than the United Jewish Fund, it was very interesting that each person in the group, each group had a particular institution that they supported strongly, but they all got together with the United Jewish Fund as a central organization. Now, for Sidney Stark, it was the Jewish Home for the Aged. For the remaining members of the Health Club, like Buck Gefsky and Manny Spector and Sid Busis's father, I can't remember his first name, they were interested in the Y, M and WHA. There was the Kaufman group with I.D. Wolf and their people who were interested in the hospital. So each one had a specific effort. But Sidney Stark was, in effect, the Jewish Home for the Aged. He was the motor, the driving force behind that place. It so happened that I became the physician for the Jewish Home for the Aged in 1948 or 49 when I finished my internship.
You mentioned that.
And And one morning, I would go there every morning and make rounds, and one morning I happened to go, and the city was totally frozen over. Nothing was moving. Everybody was locked into their homes, and driving was impossible. And I went to make my routine rounds, and Sidney Stark was there. And he could not get over the fact that I came out on that morning to see patients. And from that day on, we became fast friends. He always, after that, called upon me for anything that had to do with young people. And so that he had those kind of characteristics which should not go unnoticed. He was able to redeem his relationships and his work and efforts for the United Jewish Fund in particular, and for the Jewish Home in general, were just unbelievable. I remember going to meetings, for example, how I got involved with some of those meetings of the health club, when they would pass out cards, and the health club made a principle. This health club was a group of men who worked out at the Y, and that's how they became affiliated as a group. And they would sit around and pass out hundreds of United Jewish Fund pledge cards. And anyone that, and everybody said, I know that man, I'll take that card. I know that man, I'll take that card. And anyone that somebody in the group didn't know, Sidney Stark would take. He would take 50 cards in one of those sessions. And he would solicit it, wasn't he? Just took them and put them in his drawer. So there was a lot he said about those kinds of contributions that were made in those days. And Manny Spector was another one like that. So that was my experience with these men. And gradually, they died off, retired, and so forth. And it's interesting that the German groups in the community gradually attenuated. Their stronghold was the Concordia Club. Concordia Club was a German-Jewish club. You couldn't even become a member, no matter how strong you were politically or financially, if you had not been of the German, of the so-called R crowd. And it was not until after the war, after World War II, that they began to have some decrease in their overall population and their overall financial wealth and power. And with costs of living going up and so forth, they could not really maintain the club on that very limited basis. One of the reasons, of course, was that Jews don't drink whiskey, and most clubs are maintained by the profits made on the sale of alcoholic beverages. So they were no longer in a position to just maintain this club with a very select membership, and it was about that time, and particularly with war veterans coming back, that it became a rather unpleasant and onerous situation to return down a war veteran just because his father was born in Russia and not in Germany. So gradually they started to take in other members, and that kind definition of separation in the Jewish community began to fade. It's interesting, however, the Rod of Sholem Temple, almost to this day, is strongly controlled by that concept and that group of people. I remember, for example, I did talk about that, I'm sure.
Not really. You never said before that you felt that Rod of Sholem was still in that mode.
Well, I think that it has changed a great deal, but I think that there is still a strong body of those people who have control of the board, who tend in that direction, and I think I've already talked about how they didn't cooperate, did I not, with the major drive of the country for loan guarantees, did I not talk about that? But I mean about the Rod of Sholem was the only synagogue that I'm aware of anywhere that absolutely failed to pitch in and help on this project. It was a simple project. We wanted every rabbi from every pulpit in the country at that time, and I did. And they were the ones that did not do it. Rabbi Stateman who was one of the younger rabbis at the temple. I remember his making a speech 15 years ago. This is 30 years after the establishment of the State of Israel, making a statement that maybe it's time that we recognize the State of Israel. So it was almost as though the Reform movement has the concept that they would not accept or recognize Israel. So some of that perpetuated till very recent years. But I think that pretty much covers how much I can tell with any authority about that group of men and that division. And the point of the division really was that the German Jewish, those of German Jewish origin, primarily supported local institutions. Those of Eastern European origin primarily supported the United Jewish Appeal, and it took many years before we were able to establish a joint organization where members of both communities were active in all organizations. And as a matter of fact, that's now called the United Jewish Federation, and has members from all walks of life and all origins of birth. Well, let me see. Let's go on now. Talk. I think maybe I did not talk about, and I've always wondered, one little incident in my life that was very meaningful, and that's my connection with the Haganah. Did I not talk about that?
Very briefly, you know,
well, maybe I did.
Go ahead.
If I did talk about it, then stop me. But when I was a medical student, I was living at home at the Ruskin Apartments in Oakland, and I got a telephone call one day, and I think that was in 1947. So I was a junior in medical school. And the telephone call said, this late Kessler, yes, you don't know my name, and I don't know you, but I've been given your name, and I must meet with you privately. I said, well, who gave you my name? And they said, Arthur Jaffe. Arthur Jaffe happened to be a friend of mine and a fraternity brother from Penn State, and I knew that Arthur Jaffe had joined the Haganah after World War II. Art Jaffe was in the military, was a captain in the, I think he was, if I recall, in the military as a propaganda officer, information and so forth, whatever they call that division. And after the war, he left for Palestine, was then called Palestine, and joined the Haganah. I knew that if this man used his name, and he was obviously by sound, and his description was an Israeli, that it was certainly appropriate for me to meet with him. And he said, I can't talk to you on the telephone because my telephone is tapped. And he explained that, then he said, if you'll meet with me, I'll tell you the whole story. And he said, we can't talk on the telephone. At any rate, we arranged to meet at what was called Webster Hall Coffee Shop. Webster Hall Coffee Shop was a sort of a meeting place for many Jews at that time because it was in the what we call the Civic Center, close to the YMWHA, close to the University of Pittsburgh, close to the Syria Mosque where the symphony played, and so forth, close to the Soldier and Sailors Memorial. So it was a real meeting place. They had a special coffee cake, and everybody ordered that coffee cake. I'm sure you remember that. At any rate, we agreed, and I said, how will we know each other? Because it's a rather busy place. And we set a date. He said, I will know you, because Arthur gave me your description. I walked in, and this gentleman walked up to me, and he said, my name is so-and-so. I don't remember his name. I do remember, however, that he was from the kibbutz Ein HaShofet. And the reason I know that name stuck in my mind, but that name has come up a couple of times in my exposure to Jewish affairs since that time. And he explained to me that this was 1947. It was right before the State of Israel was declared, not long before. The United Nations was already debating the division of Palestine. into Jewish and Arab segments. And there was a great deal of hostility, particularly within our government, about any bending or leaning toward the Jewish cause. There was a great deal of emotional sentiment that one can understand because of the terrible loss of life in the Holocaust, so that there was a mixed battle going on. There were the Arabists in our government who steadfastly supported the principle that we had to be careful and support the Arabs. And there were the humanitarians in our government who said, no, wait a minute, there's a time and place for everything, and we have to consider the displaced persons and the refugee Jews. However, the Arabs were already starting to respond to this by attacking Jewish settlements in Palestine. The British were responding to this by shutting off immigration to Palestine just at a time when there was no other place for the Jewish refugees of World War II, the survivors, as we call them, to go. They were stuck in France and in Italy, and I think they've discussed that, and a lot of that will be in my diary. But there was nowhere for them to go. They didn't make, they couldn't get in under the quotas for the United States. As a matter of fact, Canada, I remember, agreed to accept 1,000 Jewish children. Of course, they had to pass all the physical tests. So there was some got in some were accepted in South American countries. It was a very difficult situation. Boats were leaving from Marseille and other ports for the Mediterranean. They were being tracked by the British. As soon as they would get near the waters of the Middle East port in Palestine, the British would threaten to shoot them down, sink them if they didn't turn around. We ended up with these people who had been in detention camps for many years being then sent to Cyprus in more detention camps. The British were very hostile. They were not cooperative. There were major exceptions like Major Wingate, General Wingate, but nonetheless, the British policy at that time was to be very careful with the Arabs because of the oil situation. Oil wrote the bottom line. When it became evident that the Jews were going to have to defend themselves, even if they were granted the division of Palestine, and Ben-Gurion agreed that half a loaf was better than none, and he would accept the recommendation of the Commission on Palestine to divide it in two, a war and attacks on Jews began immediately. The British were supposed to be the intermediaries and protect its population of the Middle East, but in effect they sided toward the Arabs, even allowing the Arabs to steal, if you will, using a euphemism, their armaments so that they could use them to attack the Jews. Matter of fact, it was well known that the famous Jordan military was trained and developed by the British. So the Jews had no place to turn. The United States...
Was it General Glob Pasha?
That's right. That was General Pasha. The Jews had no place to turn. There was no major country that was willing to stick out their neck and support them. The United States at that time was trying to be very neutral. Britain was hostile. France was anxious only to get rid of its refugees, who they couldn't very well get rid of without there being a Palestine. But on the other hand, they were heavily dependent on Arab oil, since they had no fuel sources or energy sources within their own country. And this is the same in Italy and all of Europe. They all depended on oil from the Middle East. And they were threatened that if they did anything to help the Jews establish the state, that they would be cut off. And De Gaulle was probably one of the worst offenders because he was a Frenchman through and through and what was good for France. And of course, all countries have a principle that what we do in the interests of our country, and we don't do for humanitarian reasons. So though there were those who preached humanitarian aspects and the need to establish a state of Israel, there was basically the governments did not operate that way. So where were they going to get arms? First of all, they got arms from volunteers. We had young pilots flying antiquated American planes whose commanding officer may look the other way simply because he was sympathetic but could not publicly say so because of the American position, and the guy would be discharged and he would take a plane and fly it to Israel. And that's how Israel got some of its armament. The Czechs were very sympathetic, and the Czechs were allowing us to buy some communist munitions for the Haganah, which was the pre-Israeli, now known as the Israel Defense Force. They trained with broomsticks, and they would march in the desert at night, out of sight of anybody, learning discipline, learning communications, learning codes. It was an army of the people in the true sense, but they had to have guns. They decided to come to America in the hopes of at least getting money. Theoretically, you could buy